It's May 20th, Sunday morning. This is our summation session of the fifth Mishnah of the third Perek, after everyone's learned on Chavruta. Masechet Brachot, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Hey. So the Mishnah says, Haya omed batfila v'nizkar shehu valkeri, lo yafsik ela yikatzer. So, this person is standing in tefillah, and he remembered suddenly that he's a Valkeri. He should not stop, rather he should shorten. What does it mean to shorten? It apparently means to say some short form of the Shemona Esrei. Perhaps it means just to say the chatimot of each of the brachot, but not to say the full content. I'm really not sure beyond that, but there is such a thing as a short Shemona Esrei in that sense. But let's now look at the rest of that line. So this person apparently became a Balkeri apparently at night, and he wakes up in the morning and he should remember to go to the mikveh before he does anything else, but he forgot and he begins to daven, and suddenly in the middle of davening he remembers, by davening I mean the Shemona Esrei, tefillah in the specific sense of that word, and he remembers. What does he do? So it says something strange. It says not only what he should do, but it says what he shouldn't do. He shouldn't lo yafsik. Now it would only say shouldn't stop. We'd only say that if there was a reason to think that he should stop. If it says don't stop. If there's no reason to think that he would stop, then it wouldn't say don't stop. So why would someone think instinctively that if he's a Balkeri and he's davening that he should stop?
He's doing something. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, right. No.
He's doing something he's not allowed to do.
Doing something he's not supposed to do. So we learn from here that the best case scenario is that a Balkeri should not daven. Shouldn't daven at all. It's not that we learn that he should daven bihirhur, because the very nature of tefillah, as opposed to Shemona Esrei, is it's done bihirhur. It's not done out loud. It's not like learning. It's not like Kriyat Shema that's said out loud, that it's mashmi elo's no, you have to let your ears hear. The tefillah is not like that. So the person's already been saying it bihirhur by its very nature, and he suddenly remembers that he shouldn't be saying it at all. So since you already started, we say don't stop, but just likatzer, probably for purposes of kavod shemaim, honor to a Kodesh Baruch. You don't just stop in the middle and walk away in the middle of a such with a Kodesh Baruch Hu. But it apparently, lehatchila, to begin with, he wasn't supposed to have davened at all, even though davening is said bihirhur. So now let's plug that in to what we know from the previous Mishnah. We had two different ways of reading the previous Mishnah. What did it tell us about a derabbanan? So I go back to the chart. My memory is just not good enough. You know, I've learned this probably 30 times. That's why I have the chart. I go back to the chart, which has the left-hand side and the right-hand side. So if we look at the left-hand side of the chart, concerning the matters that are derabbanan, like the blessings of the Shema and the blessings before the meal, it had us reading them bihirhur. In other words, the Mishnah, previous Mishnah, could have been telling us that matters that are derabbanan are said bihirhur. That was the way of reading the Mishnah, that the first line of it was one unit and not two. I'm reading that line, Balkeri meharher bilibo veino mivarech. According to this way of learning it, it was talking about the brachot, and it was saying that you meharher them, but you don't mivarech them. In other words, what you do is you say them quietly, whereas Shema itself, which is Doraita, is unimpinged upon by the Takana according to this way of learning it. Ah, so if that's the way we learn it, then it's telling us that something that's the Rabbanan, you say bihirhur if you're Valkeri. That doesn't fit with our Mishnah. So our Mishnah, you're already doing something bihirhur. The very nature of Shemona Esrei is bihirhur, and it still is a matter that you should have not begun to begin with. So apparently we can learn very clearly from here that the proper way of learning the previous Mishnah is not this column, because according to this column, derabbanan, you say bihirhur when you're a Balkeri. According to our Mishnah, derabbanan, you don't say even bihirhur to begin with. So that means we have to go to this column as far as the proper way of understanding the previous Mishnah. And according to the right-hand column, the first line of the previous Mishnah was two separate units. The first sentence, Balkeri meherher b'libo, that's one thing. Einom b'varech, on the other hand, thing. The Meraher Belibo, that's the right, that's the Shema it's talking about. That you say Behir Hur. But something that's the Rabbanan, Einom Mevarech at all. The brachot, you don't say at all. Not even Vihiror. So it turns out that apparently that Mishnah Hay sheds light on how to read Mishnah Dalet, and the proper way of reading Mishnah Dalet is that something that's Doraita, if you're a Balkari, you do Vihiror, and something that's Darabanan, you don't do it all. And since Tfilah's Darabanan, then I'd learn you don't daven at all. If you haven't gone to the mikveh, you don't daven at all. And the Rabbanan have the authority to cancel Tfilah because Tfilah is the Rabbanan. And the Rabbanan can cancel the Rabbanan. They can undo their own takana. The way we say this in Talmudic language, that the Rabbanan have the power to undo their own takana, is in the following phrase. Hem amru v'hem amru. They said and they said. If they said X, then they could say not X. Hem amru v'hem amru. They said and they said. Okay. So now we can go on in our Mishnah. Until now, the first line and a half of the Mishnah, we're talking about Tfilah. But now it switches back to the Kriyat Shema, which was the subject of the previous Mishnah. Yerad Litbol, he went down to the mikveh. Now, it's not a case in which you began doing your religious obligations and then you remembered that you're a Balkari, you have to run to the mikveh. Rather, you remembered, you woke in the morning, you knew you were a Balkari, so you went, Yerad Litbol. But the problem is that Kriyat Shema has a very, very short window of opportunity to say it in the morning. You don't have a lot of time to get to the mikveh and then to say Kriyat Shema, because let's just remember, it's only so early you can wake up because there's no electric lights. Everything is completely dark outside before Alot HaShachar. Once Alot HaShachar comes a little bit of light, and you can start walking around, the time of Kriyat Shema begins 20 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes after Alot HaShachar. After the first light, it begins when you have enough time to distinguish between green and blue, or green and white. Techelet v'charte, or techelet v'levan. And then you only have until, according to the Tanakhama of the second Mishnah of the first Perk, you only have until Hanitzachama to finish saying Kriyat Shema. It's perhaps 20 minutes from the first time to the last time, from the time you can distinguish between blue and white, or blue and green, until the sun actually comes up. You have a 20 minutes, maximum of half an hour. Not a lot of time. So what happens? So Yerad Litbol, you got up at the first dawn, crack of dawn, you ran to the mikveh, and you're trying to get out of the mikveh in order to say Kriyat Shema before the time ends. I should remind us that, of course, that second Mishnah of the first chapter did say that according to Rabbi Yeshua, you have until 3 hours of the day. But this is not the first time we've seen that the halach is assumed to be according to the Tanakhama. We also saw in a bright of Rabbi Akiva working with his colleagues on the road, if you remember, in the Tosefta. And it said that they should have said Shema by the time that the sun came up, and then someone saw that they were saying it after that, and he thought that they completely missed the time. Is it indeed the second Mishnah of the of the first chapter? That's it? Okay. Very good. So the assumption seems to be here, you only have until Hanitzachama. So what happens? So it says, Yerad Litbol, you went down to the mikveh, Im yachol la'lot u'lehit kasot v'likrot ad shalot Hanitzachama, yalev yitkasev yikra, excuse me. If he's able to come up out of the water, v'lit kasot, and to cover himself with a blanket or with his clothing, v'likrot, and to read, and likrot always means likrot kriyat shema, never means anything else. I take it back. It never means to daven Shmona Esrei. It could mean likrot b'mishnah. No, it could mean, okay, I apologize. Likrot always means to read words of scripture. And therefore it includes the saying of Kriyat Shema, which is in the Torah. But the expression is also likrot b'mishnah, likrot b'torah, to fulfill the mitzvah of simply learning words of Torah Shebichtav. So likrot refers to Torah Shebichtav. Lishnot refers to words of Torah Shebal Peh. Lishnot Mishnah, to repeat Mishnah. So anyway, likrot refers here not to Tfilah and not to Torah Shebal Peh, but to Torah Shebichtav, which is the Kriyat Shema. If you can read the Shema, until will not shine the sun, in other words, until it won't be Hanitzachama, then Yalevi Kasev Yikra, then you should go out of the water and cover yourself and do it, fine. you're really running against the sun, but if you make it, if you're not going to make it, great. Vim lav, and if not, if you know that you got to the water 5 minutes late, and you know that if you try and get out of the water and dry yourself and cover yourself, the sun will already come up, you really see it's about to come up, then what are you going to do? Krit Shema's Doraita, you have to say it. Yitkaseh v'mayim v'yikra. You should cover yourself in the water and read. Right? Which means that you're still naked, but you're covered by the water, so you can say Kriyat Shema. Of course, that's not something you should do to begin with, because you should be in an honorable situation, but if you have no choice, it's better to say Kriyat Shema when you're in the water than to not say it at all.
So this is cover yourself with the water, not
with the water.
Something while with the you're water. Inside the water.
Yeah.
So you submerge yourself.
Stays in the water. And you say Shema while you're in the water.
What about, does he ever have a kippah on?
Ooh, I didn't even think of that. So let's think for a second.
Do you wear a kippah when you go on a mikvah? No, right? And you have to be...
Wait, is this, let me think. I don't remember any reference to kippah in the Mishnah at all. In the Talmud, in Braitot, and in the Amoritic material of the Gemara, there's discussions that only very, very special people wore head coverings. Most Jews, including scholars, didn't wear kippah at all, didn't cover their heads. It wasn't a universal custom, even at the time of the Talmud.
To wear a kippah, you mean?
To wear any kippah, to wear any head covering. It seems to be that sometimes they put them on when they got married. There's this famous story in which one scholar came to another to ask a question. He wasn't wearing a kippah, and he said, "Why aren't you married?" And he said, "I'm only 16. But it wasn't a good answer. There are other cases in which we see that there's a mother that put a kippah on her little baby to make sure that he'd really be a great, great, great scholar, but it didn't seem to have been the custom at the time, and even the time of the Middle Ages, it wasn't a universal custom to cover the head. It's only in the past 400 years that discussion develops, is it a halakha to put in a kippah or not? Before that, in the Middle Ages, it was done, but it wasn't a halakha, and in the time of the Talmud, like I said, it doesn't seem to have been a universal custom at all. So, therefore, the question really is one we can't answer. So, but I want to say a few things about covering yourself in the water. What actually is this halacha of covering yourself for a Kriyat Shema? So, there are two issues. One issue is that your erva shouldn't be exposed. Your private part shouldn't be exposed. And another halacha is that ein libo ro'eh et ha'erva. That your heart shouldn't see your private parts. Two separate things. One, that the erva shouldn't be exposed. Number two, that your heart shouldn't see your private parts. What does that mean? It means that there should be a distinction between the upper and the lower. When the expression, your heart shouldn't see the erva, means there has to be a belt on, has to be a distinction between top and low. That the top half can't be connected to the bottom half. Has to be distinguished. So two separate halachot. So therefore, we come to the following. If, for example, you're dressed in a robe and only in a robe, without a belt, well, that's called that your erva is covered, because the outside world can't see it, but it's called that your heart can see your erva. So you're not allowed to say Kriyat Shema or anything else, tefillah or learning, unless you're wearing a belt.
Is that the idea of the levavitch is
garden? Yes, yes. But of course, if you're wearing, let's say, underwear, then that already solves the problem, because the elastic divides between the upper and the lower. So it's two separate halachot, that you can't be exposed to the erva, and that the top and the bottom have to be separated. Ah, so now what happens with it when you're in the water? So therefore, paradoxically, it's better, if you're saying Shema when you're in the water, it's better not to go into the water up to your neck. Because if you go in the water up to your neck, then, I mean, I'm talking about clear water, by the way, I'm talking about clear water. So then, no, let me start at the other side of it. If you go into clear water, only up to your waist, that's called that your erva is michuse, is covered, even though the water is clear, but there's something there. And secondly, it's called the distinction between the upper and the lower, because the upper is in the air and the lower is in the water. So you're allowed to say Shema, according to all opinions, when you're naked in clear water up to your waist. But if you go deeper into the water, it becomes more problematic. Because if you're covered up to here in clear water, then it's called that your erva is not galui, it's not exposed, because it's in water. But there's some that say that now there's no distinction between the upper and the lower. Being in clear water up to your neck is like wearing a robe without a belt. There's no belt in the water. And therefore what you have to do is either go higher in the water so your chest's out of the water, or you have to put your ankle down in the mud and stir up the mud. And if you stir up the mud, then it's considered to be that there is a distinction between upper and lower, according to some opinions. Just thought I'd add that interesting element if anyone ever encounters it. Okay. Aval lo yitkase lo v'mayim hara'im, but you shouldn't cover yourself in bad water, which means smelly water. V'lo v'mei hamishra, and not in soaking water, like we said, flax water, which is extremely, extremely smelly, so we're told. Yeah. Now, notice there's no problem with immersing yourself in dirty, smelly water. The problem is just saying Shema when you're in that water. But you're allowed to go to a filthy mikveh. There's no problem with that. You can stomach it.
Okay. Why the repetition of smelly water and smelly water? Why not just say...
I can only guess that the vav that begins the phrase below b'meha mishra is to be interpreted as, for example,
I see.
No, you shouldn't cover yourself in smelly water, for example, flax water.
Mm. What about rainwater?
Rainwater, as long as it's not smelly, is fine. It's kosher for saying Shema while you're in it. Yeah. Ad shiatil letochan mayim.
I just want to say, it could be that in the idiomatic usage or the euphemism of the day, that the first phrase meant something worse.
Aha. Uh-huh. That mayim ra'im would mean urine, you mean?
Well, just it could be sewage, water that had sewage, you know, some excrement in it, for example.
Aha. Uh-huh.
We don't know, really. Or uh-huh. Garbage that was rotting or something.
I see.
More. Right. And then it would say, not that, and even something
right.
Which is not filthy in that sense, but if it smells bad, like this stuff mm-hmm. that you use, it's part of your work, you're used to it, you're around it, it's not disgusting and normal, but you should...
Great.
So we're not talking about 50%
of the waters in America are polluted,
yeah.
And so they're not kosher to go in that water.
If it smells.
You cannot swim in it, you cannot use it as a mikvah.
Right, I mean, we're probably talking about like a river or some
river,
common, something that's not necessarily controlled.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, of course, remember that in Talmudic times, a mikveh was usually a stone, carved stone that was full of water, and it filled up in the winter, and by April and May the rain stopped, and by June, July, August, 1,000 people had been in that mikveh. It didn't smell too well by the end of the summer, right? And not only that, but the algae and the other things that might have been swimming in it, it might not have been a pleasant place. Yeah.
They have that that symbol P next to the mikveh. Yeah. You don't see it. I don't know if you've heard that term. And people have it by swimming pools. It's, you don't see it, shouldn't be in it. Mm.
No. Ad shiatil letochan mayim. Right, so you shouldn't cover yourself in such water unless you cast into it water. So this is difficult to understand, because how could you cast into enough water to get rid of the smell? If you have a big mikveh of water, and even if it's a small mikveh of water, you'd have to take lots and lots of buckets of water in order to put enough water, clean water, to get rid of the smell. So it's really difficult to understand what's going on here. Let me tell you what the Yerushalmi says. The Yerushalmi says that it's not talking about putting enough water in to get rid of the smell. It's only talking about putting enough water to symbolically show that you're dealing with the issue. So the Yerushalmi reads it, until you put in a little bit of water. Take a pail of clean water, pour it in, that's enough, even if the water is still smelly. That's the position of the Talmud Yerushalmi.
Why is there the flax-soaked water in the mikvah to begin with? I mean, that's not something you would use the water for.
That's a good question. Okay, so that brings us to the following. There are many sources that indicate that the water that you have to immerse yourself in order to live up to the conditions of Takanat Ezra, is not the same stringency of water that you need to immerse yourself for biblical Tumah. There's a Mishnah in Masechet Mikvaot that says explicitly that you're allowed to immerse yourself in Maim She'uvim, I'll explain that in a minute, Maim She'uvim, in order to fulfill the conditions of Takanat Ezra. Maim She'uvim means tap water that you're not allowed to put in the mikveh. Mikveh has to be natural water, rainwater. If it goes through a vessel, it's not kosher. But for Takanat Ezra, all you have to do is take a bath in enough water, if 39 seah of water, a big bathtub. It can even be mined from the tap, water from the tap. By the way, there are even those who say that a shower is enough for Takanat Ezra, that if that much water is falling on you, it's enough. That's another question. But in any case, it means that if you have a barrel of water in your tannery, you could theoretically immerse yourself in it for Takanat Ezra.
It doesn't have to be clean water.
It doesn't have to be clean. The only question of cleanliness is if you want to say Shema when you're in the barrel of water. Right.
And that's where it comes in. If you throw the pail in, then it's considered clean.
It's, even if it still smells, according to the Yerushalmi, as long as you symbolically put in enough water, I think the Yerushalmi says a rivi'it, right, a glass of water, then that's okay.
That's interesting because a tannery smells so bad in general, let alone the water.
Yeah. I really shouldn't have said tannery.
So
what is the name of the building in which you soak flax?
That'd be the flax room.
Flax room, thank you.
So a swimming pool would certainly suffice for a male.
For Takanat Ezra.
Right.
Or male mikvah. Right. 100%. 100%.
Would it suffice for a woman's mikvah?
No.
Because it rains?
But the water comes into it through vessels, through pipes.
It has to come in through pipes?
No, that's what makes it bad.
Oh, well, the pool is filled with rainwater.
If it's only filled with rainwater?
It has to be only rainwater?
I'm not going to get into all the halachot of mikveh here. It's very, very complicated. But if you have a swimming pool that's only filled with rainwater, then theoretically you have fulfilled the conditions of a mikveh and can invite the women of the neighborhood into your pool.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So, and then the last line of the Mishnah, I should say the last sentence, V'chama yarchik mihem umin hatsoa arba amot. And how much should you distance from them and from excrement for amot? So here we clearly see that the Mishnah has begun a new topic without telling us. Until now we've been talking about immersing yourself for the purposes of Takanat Ezra, and we've also been talking about saying Shema while you're in the water, which you immersed yourself in for Takanat Ezra. And suddenly it says, how far should you distance from the water and from excrement for amot? But who's talking about distancing yourself? The subject is being inside the water, because you didn't have time to get out. So the Mishnah has changed to a new subject without telling us. So if we're going to print it should be a new paragraph. And the matter is that since we've already been talking about dirty water, we're beginning a new subject that has to do with dirty water. And the new subject is, if you just want to say Shema in normal conditions, and there has to be, and there happens to be a puddle of smelly water next to you, how far do you have to distance yourself from it? And the answer is, for a moat. To be give the full answer, it can't be in your line of sight. But if it's outside of your line of sight, to the back or to the sides, then you only have to distance yourself for a moat.
Why would it be limiting to sight if it's smelly water that might permeate?
Yeah, because, thank you for the question, because there's two issues. One is seeing it, the other is smelling it. You can't see it at all. Not allowed to look at it. Look at the filth. Like we're also talking about soa, about excrement. You can't see it. But if you're not seeing it, there's also a problem of smell. How far do you have to go away from it? So you might say, as far as I have to, so the smell won't be obvious. But the Mishnah gives an easier answer. Four amot is enough. Four amot really is, you know, just four of these. It's not so much. So now, let's examine a little bit further the last two lines of the Mishnah. We had said you shouldn't cover yourself in dirty, smelly water and not in flax water until you cast into it water. Then it said, how far should you distance yourself from it and from the excrement? Four amot. So there was clearly a change of subject. And until this very minute, I've been assuming the change of subject is where they put the period of here. The tochan mayim, period. New subject. Last four words of the second to last line. V'chama yarchik mihem u'minatsoa arba amot. That's a new subject. But wait a second. I'm going to suggest something else now. We said that the words ad shiati l'tochan mayim, until he casts into the water, are problematic. The Yerushalmi says it means a symbolic casting of water, but if you don't accept the Yerushalmi, you're wondering, how can you cast enough water in to get rid of the smell? And I don't know. Question mark. Yeah. Then period. Then a new subject. The new subject is, how far should you distance yourself from water when you want to be outside of the water and just want to say Shema? The answer is four amot. So what I'm going to say is as follows. Given that there's a subject change, that's issue number one, and given that the words that come right before where the subject change has to occur are difficult, let's try and solve the problem by moving up the subject change, by advancing the subject change, and say it's not after the period, it's rather four words before the period. Right after the comma, right after the words b'mei hamishra will be the subject change. So let's try it like this. It says that you shouldn't cover yourself in dirty water and smelly water and the water of the flax, period. And then ad shiatila tochan mayim, until you cast into the water, is not dealing with the subject we've been dealing with of being in the water. It's a new subject. It's a new subject that we certain is brought up at the end of the Mishnah. We're saying it's brought up here, which is, just say you're walking on the path and you want to now say Kriyat Shema. And what do you do if you have this dirty water right in front of you? So the answer is you turn aside, but it still smells. What do you do? Ad shiati l'tochan mayim, until you put water into it. In other words, you came across a little puddle, not a big mikvah, a little puddle of dirty water. What do you have to do in order to say Shema in the area? And let's say it's in a small room, you can't escape from the room, you can't just walk away. So the answer is ad shiati l'tochan mayim. And if we're talking about a little puddle and not a mikvah that you would have been in, then we can understand how you might be able to bring enough water to actually counteract the smell. And then the subject goes on. V'kama yarchik mihem, and how far should go away? Let's say you don't have water to throw into the puddle to get rid of the smell. So you're just going to walk away. How far do you have to walk away? The answer is four amot. So what we have is the following. The Mishnah clearly begins a new topic. We just don't know where. And we can move up the beginning of the new topic and therefore solve a problem in a fashion other than the way the Yerushalmi did. The Yerushalmi said, it's just a symbolic casting of a little bit of water into the mikveh. The way the Bavli does it, what I'm saying now is the Bavli's way of learning it. So when we began a new subject and it's just a little puddle of water and it's telling you put enough water into the puddle to really dissipate the smell. And if you don't have enough water, then just walk away. How far do you walk away? For a moment. This matter of it beginning a new subject without telling us, we have to figure it out. There are actually words are missing in a certain sense. Words are missing. We should look back at the Mishnah, the second to last line, after the first two words of the line, the Mea Mishra, period. The water of soaking, period. And then there are words missing, which would be something like, and if you're walking on the way, and you want to say Shema, and you encounter a puddle of water, what do you do? And the answer is, throw into them water or walk away. And those words are missing. The words that say, if you're on your way and you're walking, you encounter a puddle and you want to say Shema. Yeah. The words are missing. And this happens infrequently, but it does happen in the Mishnah, when the Gemara is forced to say that Chasuri Mechzara V'Hachi Katani. Words are missing and this is what it means. Chasuri Mechzara V'Hachi Katani. Words are missing and this is what it means. Chasurei mechsara means missing, missing. Chaser means missing. Chasurei mechsara, missing, missing. And this is what it means. And whenever the Gemara does such a thing, we always ask ourselves, and this is related to what Yaakov brought up 2 hours ago, are they doing it on the basis of a tradition they have, or on the basis of Svara, the mind? Given that the Yerushalmi disagrees, the Yerushalmi says it's not a new subject when it says Ad Shiyatil Atochan Mayim. It's hard to believe that the Bavli has an authentic tradition that the Yerushalmi doesn't have. The Yerushalmi is in Eretz Yisrael, where the Mishnah was formulated. The Bavli is in Bavel. To say that the Bavli had a more authentic tradition than the Yerushalmi is not the most probable case. And therefore, in this particular case, you probably would come to the conclusion that the Bavli is using Svara. Svara that says there must be words missing. I don't know. I don't have the tradition, but there's no other way to understand it. And it doesn't think of the Yerushalmi's way, but it's just talking about symbolically throwing in a few glasses of water. So the Bavli is creative because it has no choice but to be creative to understand the words we have in front of us. Hasuri mechsara v'hachi katani. Okay. So how are we doing? In other words, are there any issues in this Mishnah that you're talking about in Chavruta that we didn't talk about right now? Let's just think about that for a minute. I'll myself think also. So I guess I'll say a few more things. One thing I wanted to point out is that this matter of being in the water and saying what you're supposed to say in the water is only discussed here for Shema, not for Tefillah. Yeah? And that's for two reasons. Only Shema would require such a thing, because only Shema is such a small window of opportunity to say it, until the sun comes up. With tefillah, you'll never be stuck in such a situation, because tefillah you have until the end of 4 hours. We didn't discuss this yet. We'll get to the next chapter. You have until 4 hours of the day. So you have a lot of time from the time the sun goes up to get to the mikveh to say tefillah. But Kriyat Shema, you have a small window of opportunity, so you might be stuck in the mikveh when the time is running out. That's the first point. The second point is that tefillah, you'd never be allowed to say it in the water, because tefillah requires standing before Kodesh Baruch. It requires proper dress. It requires kavod. Shema, being a community declaration, not between God and man, requires much less as far as your situation. It's a matter of uvelechtech avaderech. Going back to our theme we've seen again and again and again, when you're in your normal way, and if your normal way happens to be in the swimming pool, so that's where you say Kriyat Shema. So, and again, if I just mentioned swimming pool, the same thing goes for a swimming pool. If you happen to have to say Shema in the swimming pool, that's where you do it. Of course, that brings up the question of kippah, which didn't exist at this time. But as far as the setting of kavod, you don't require any type of proper clothing beyond what we've already talked about in order to say Shema. That's point number one. Point number two, there is this terminology that I wanted to cover, which is the phrases that we've used, lahatchila and bidiyavad, and I also wanted to add another word we've used in the past, bishat adchak. These things come up here. So just to review that, we said lahatchila, you should go to the mikveh, get out of the mikveh, dry and cover yourself, and then say Shema. That's lechatchila, that's the best way to do it. That's the optimal circumstance. Lechatchila means to begin with, the optimal circumstance, the best way.
Will you just remind us the root of what the root means?
Like to begin, lechatchil. Hatchala means beginning.
Shatatrak means short time.
So Shatatrak is the next phrase. Just let's make sure we have Lehatchila, right? The
have time to get dressed.
Right. Right. Lehatchila, we know the word Matchil, to begin. Hatchala, beginning. Yeah. Matchilim are beginners. Say it again?
You skipped the Yemen.
All right, I skipped on purpose. So now, b'shat adchak, the phrase b'shat adchak means b'shat, at the hour, b'sha'ah, at the hour of emergency. Dchak means urgency.
He has no water. He has no chance to get dressed.
Right, exactly.
Before the sun.
B'shat adchak, the hour of emergency, means how to do the mitzvah when you don't have optimal conditions. And we learned here that b'shat adchak, you're allowed to say Kriyat Shema in the water. At the hour of emergency, at the hour of urgency, you can say Kriyat Shema. The third phrase is b'di'avad. B'di'avad means after the, exactly, after the fact. And b'di'avad would be as follows. I know that I'm supposed to say Shema after getting out of the mikveh. But what can I do? I didn't have time. And I said Shema while I was in the water. But I didn't know that the Mishnah allows it. I said Shema in the water. So after I said Shema in the water, I go to my Rav and I ask, did I do the right thing? And he says to me, Lahatchila, you should have gotten out of the water. But b'diavad, after the fact, if you said Shema in the water, then yatsa, fulfilled your obligation. Or he might say, lo yatsa. Well, that's not the halachai, but in a certain case I might have asked, if I said Shema after 3 hours of the day, yatzah or lo yatzah, the answer would be lo yatzah. So lehatchila is the best way of doing things. B'shat adchak is doing it under non-optimal circumstances, and b'diavad means if you already did it under non-optimal circumstances, and I ask after the fact, did I fulfill the obligation?
What's the shorish for b'diavad? Is that
b'diavad? It's Aramaic. B, d, avad. B in, d that in that avad did in that he did.
Okay, so
it's done already. Avad in Aramaic is the same as asa in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it was bisha asa. In that he did it already. Did it work or did it not work? So that is enough for that Mishnah.
So, Shas, Hadchak, and B'diavad are related?
Very often it's the same law. In other words, very usually, what I'm allowed to do B'shat Hadchak, that's what, if I did it, then B'diavad Yatsa. Not always, but very usually. Very usually. So let me point out. But b'shat adchak, in our case, is that I said Shema when I'm in the water because I had no choice. It was a time of urgency. But another case would be, I had all the time in the world, but I just happened to want to say Shema while I was in the water. I did it and I said, wait a second, was that proper? So I run to the Rav and I ask, b'diavad, was it okay? And they'll say, you shouldn't have done it, but b'diavad, yatsa. Okay, next Mishnah, to finish the chapter, to finish three chapters, and by the way, we're going to finish not just the end of the third chapter now, but we're going to finish the whole first part of the Masechet. Because after the end of the third chapter, it goes to a new subject. The new subject is Tefillah. Until now, we've been doing Kriyat Shema. It's going to switch to Tefillah, and that's what we'll do on Leil Shavuot. We'll begin the matter of Tefillah. So this Mishnah, at the end of the chapter, is very strange. And there's a lot of intricate details there, but since it's not related to the subject of Shema, we can do it shortly. So the Mishnah goes like this. I gave out the piece of paper anyone else need. It says Perek Rivi'i. Perhaps Amiram didn't get. Everyone else got? I have like six copies here, so I suspect someone didn't get. No, everyone has, okay? This is Mishnah Vav. Okay, I guess I made too many copies. What it says is, Zav Shira... Oh, you didn't eat.
No, I'm know, he's given it out.
Zav shira'a keri. V'nida shepalta shichvat zera. V'mishameshet shira'ata nida tzrichim tevila. Rabbi Yehuda poter. Translation. Zav shira'a keri. A zav, which is someone with an abnormal genital flow, that saw keri. The Torah in Vayikra chapter 15. And you know what, I'll give out the question sheets for this Mishnah, even though we're not doing it as questions, but you can have the material. I'll just give them out. And the biblical sources are listed here. And it's just for your files. We're not going to do all these questions, and we're not going to have Chavruta here. But you have the biblical sources at the top of the page. So Azav is someone who's having some type of abnormal, sickly flow from his genitals. And it might be gonorrhea, or syphilis, whatever it is. The Torah says in such a case that when the flow ends, he has to count 7 days, and then go to the mikveh, and then he is pure. He is tamei until then. So azav shira'a keri. He has what's called a tumah chamura, a serious tumah of 7 days, and then he has, over and above that, at the same time, he has keri. He has a seminal emission, which is a tumah kala, which is a light tumah of only 1 day. And not only is keri a tumah, it's also, we've learned, this takanates. You can't learn Torah until you've gone to the mikveh. So he is in double jeopardy. He's a zav, and he becomes a bal keri. Okay?
But the second word, shirah.
Shirah, that saw.
Let
me explain. I'm sorry. Thank you for the question. We say someone that has keri is a bal keri. He's a master of keri. But if I want to indicate that it now came upon him, the process and not the result, I say he ra'ah keri, he saw keri, which is the euphemism for realizing, for feeling, for experiencing now, semen has left his body. Whether it's in the context of, well, usually when you say ra'ah keri, saw keri, it means out of the context of sex. It just happened to him. So he's been a zav, he's been a sick person, and suddenly he becomes a bal keri. It's two tumot at the same time. One is a tumah of 7 days, the other is a tumah of 1 day, and we remember also that the tumah of 1 day also requires, according to Takanat Ezra, going to the mikveh before he can learn Davin Seishma. That's category number one. Nida shepalta shichvat zera. A woman who's a nida, that expelled semen. Shichvat zera is the word for semen. So now let me give some background. The Torah told us, we know from the Torah, that a man who has keri, a man that is a bal keri, has tumah kala, has a light tumah of 1 day. When the sun goes down and he goes to the mikveh, it's gone. We also learn from the Torah that a woman who has keri on her body or in her body, just on her body, not in her body, that's the whole key, I just gave it away. A woman who has keri on her body but not in her body is tmeya with the tumah kala, the light tumah of 1 day. In other words, after sexual contact, semen in her body does not make her tmeya, but semen on her body at the outside makes her tmeya for 1 day, just like the man. But now we have another halakha, that a woman's body that expunges, is that the word? That expels keri, which might be after a few hours, might be after up to 3 days, when the keri comes out, it makes her tmeya again. Let's say that she had had sexual intercourse, gone to the mikveh, and now a day later, she finds that semen has left her body, she's again tmeya for tuma kala, has to go to the mikveh again. That's what's called palta shechvat zera. Her body expelled shechvat zera, which gives her tuma kala, which gives her the light tuma of one day. Now, the scenario gets more... Say it again?
To do with a miscarriage or something.
Nothing to do with a miscarriage, no.
Not a miscarriage.
So now let's look at this sentence, which is even more complicated. Nida shepalta shechvat zera. And Nida, whose body expelled semen. So what happened? It's like this. We're assuming that she is a God-fearing, observant woman. So she was tohora, she was pure. She had sexual contact with her husband. She went to the mikveh after the sexual contact to get rid of the tuma kala, the tuma of the one day of having semen on the outside of her body. And then, after she came back from the mikveh, she became a nida. She's now tmeya for 7 days. While she's a nida, her body expels now the shechvat zera. She becomes tmeya for 1 day while she was already tmeya for 7 days. Should I say it again? It's complicated. So case number two is similar to case number one in that a tuma kala, a tuma of 1 day, has added itself over and above a tuma of 7 days. Okay. The third case is child's play compared to what we already did. It's simple. The third case is hamishameshet shira'ata nida. A mishameshet literally means the user, but it's a euphemism for someone who's had tashmish hamita, who's had sexual intercourse, and it's in the feminine. Hamishameshet is the female intercourser. Shira'ata nida, that sees nida. In other words, she had intercourse, she has semen on her body, she's tmeya for 1 day, and before she manages to go to the mikveh to deal with the tumah of 1 day, she rata nida, she becomes a nida. So it's a third case of two tumot, one superimposed upon the other. What do you do in all these cases? So now let me explain the dilemma. Let me put it this way, let's talk in positive terms. If I understand this Mishnah in the context of our whole chapter, it's not concerned to laws of Tuma and Tara, it's concerned to laws of saying Shema. Which means that the Tuma of the 1 day here, the Tuma of Shechvat Zera, we're not concerned about it because the laws of Tuma and Tara. We're concerned because of the laws of Takanat Ezra. That's what's going on. We've learned that Takanat Ezra says that if you have this matter of carry, you have to go to the mikveh before you learn. So the dilemma is as follows. You have someone who has a 7-day Tuma. And now he has the problem of Takanat Ezra because of his carry. Do you send him to the mikveh in order to learn or not? You might say, of course, what's this case different than another case? If you have carry, you have to go to the mikveh in order to learn. But on the other hand, educationally, you're creating a very, very complicated situation. You're sending someone to the mikveh and you're telling him when he gets out of the mikveh, he can learn, but he's still tamei because he has 7 days of tumah in front of him. It's a very, very complicated and sociologically explosive situation that people going to the mikveh and having to remember and to identify themselves as tmeim even when they leave. And not to mention the fact that you really don't want tmei people coming out of a mikveh, because usually people who come out of a mikveh are considered to be tahor and you can touch them and here is a person coming out of a mikveh who's still tmei. Very complicated situation. But nevertheless, and despite all that, the halacha is srechim tefillah. They require tefillah. The takanat Ezra is so important to us that it overrides all of the negative possible connotations and problems of sending someone to the mikveh when he's going to come out of it still tamei for 7 days. So the Tanakhama says srechim tefillah. And Rabbi Yehuda poter, Rabbi Yehuda exempts.
He says you don't have to.
You don't have to. Apparently Rabbi Yehuda holds that either we simply don't want to create the sociological complications of having someone come out of the mikveh and still be tamei. We want to prevent the person from coming close to the mikveh until his time comes, or not to get it mixed up. So either Rabbi Yehuda is basing himself on these sociological considerations that it's just not a situation we want to create, and it's better to relax the takana of Ezra than to have people who are tamei going in and out of the mikveh, or perhaps Rabbi Yehuda simply doesn't want to burden such a sick person with another halachic liability of takanat Ezra and going to the mikveh, when really this person, if he's zav, he might be actually in bed. It might be he's suffering. And if it's a nida, does a nida want to go to the mikveh? Do we want to go into the mikveh when she's still bleeding? All different types of complicated situations are being created here. And Rabbi Yitzchak Poter is willing to let a person study Torah and say Kriyat Shema and everything connected to that, even when they're still a Baal Keri, because Takanat Ezra is only the Rabbanan willing to set it aside for overriding considerations of another sort.
Sarich clean means what?
Require. Sarich. So that's all, folks.
So this particular Mishnah is dealing with both men and women, and
yes,
the issue of going to the mikveh in order to say tefillah, as well as Kriyat Shema.
Yes, yes. And women are not obligated in Kriyat Shema, but they can say Shema. Women are, to a certain degree or another, depending on how you understand, obligated in tefillah. And women do say brachot, and women do say birkat hamazon. Yor is a woman who has, who's a balat keri, either because the semen entered her body and it's on the outside of the body, or because it's leaving the body. In those two situations, if a woman who's a balat keri, and she should not be allowed to study, or to say Kriyat Shema. By the way, you see here it's something very paradoxical, that a woman is, in a sense, more susceptible to being a Baal Keri than a man. Because she can get a double whammy when it goes in and when it goes out.
And we're interpreting this to have to do with the Takana, Ezra's Takana and Shema, etc., just from the context of where it is in this chapter, is
exactly
that right?
Exactly. If you take this Mishnah out of context, you have no idea if it's discussing Takanat Ezra that's superimposed on a seven-day Tumah, or if it's discussing a Torah one-day Tumah superimposed on a seven-day Tumah. You have no idea. There's nothing in the Mishnah that's indicative of that. And the fact that I read it talking about Takanat Ezra is only because of the context. That's 100% right.
And you certainly wouldn't know what your pater from. Rabbi Yehuda says pater
well,
from what?
You'd have to say that he's patur from going to the mikveh for his one day tumah. But what would that mean? In any case, you're always patur from going to the mikveh if it's tumah, because you don't have to go to the mikveh, you only have to refrain from going to the sanctuary, to the Beit HaMikdash. And here, this person kept going anyway because he has a seven-day tumah. So you're right about that. Let me think about that. In other words, you're saying take it out of context and try and talk about it as talking about one-day tumah superimposed on the seven-day. Then what would Rabbi Yehuda Poter mean? You're right. It would have to be Rabbi Yehuda Oser. Rabbi Yehuda forbids. I can understand Rabbi Yehuda saying, I forbid you to go because I don't want you going to the mikveh when you're going to come out to me, but to say puter from what? But in our context, it's puter, it means I exempt you from going and I still allow you to say Kriyat Shema. Yes, so it does seem that word puter only strengthens our understanding that the context is one of Takanat Ezra and not of Torah Tumah. Okay, I'll just say at the very end that you noticed perhaps that in these last two Mishnayot, we only discussed halachic minutiae. We didn't discuss any broader ideology. That's because I don't know what this could mean in the context of a broader ideology. But if you have any ideas, you can certainly tell me.
When a woman is a nida, she's put up from all the brachas.
No.
She's still saying
tefillah. Yeah.
Not the Krishna, but the tefillah.
everything that she's obligated in.
Even if she's not kosher at the time.
You're right. But actually, this is the tip of an iceberg of a machloka that's been going on for 2,000 years. The Rambam and others bear witness to the fact that there were Jewish communities that acted towards a nida as an outcast who didn't have contact with anyone and didn't say any brachot or didn't learn at all. In the Ethiopian communities, she actually lived in a separate hut for 7 days and didn't say any words of Kedusha and didn't do anything. But in the halakha, that's not found. Because remember, today we don't have laws of Tuman Tara. She's just forbidden to her husband, that's all. And the halakha has actually been doing battle for the past 1,500 years against those, let's call them discriminatory practices vis-a-vis the Nida. And a whole other subject. Okay. Shavua Tov.
Clara?